this means that this great land of liberty that we hear so much about, this land of freedom, this land which so many ways has represented hope for humanity worldwide, is in the grips of a tiny foreign country which has penetrated our political system so effectively that it manipulates its policy in respect to the most dangerous area of foreign policy, namely what is happening in the Middle East. The Middle East, where the most sacred shrines of Islam can be found, where the most sacred shrines of Christianity can be found, and also the shrines most sacred to Jews can be found. The political crossroads of the world, where political and economic pressures from the East and West, from the Third World, from the developed world, come into conflict every day of the year. It's a ticking time bomb. Consider, for example, the inventory of explosive power which exists in the Middle East today and grows every day, still greater. All of these nuclear weapons possessed by the State of Israel, all of the enormous equipment for destruction in military engagement possessed by Arab states as well as by the State of Israel, and the inventory getting higher and higher. I've heard experts on weaponry say that the inventory of firepower is so great today in the Middle East that it's only a matter of time before war will break out through accident, not by design. No one may want war at all, but these experts are convinced that the firepower which resides in that small part of the world's surface is so great that war will break out by accident. It's a ticking time bomb. NBC had a report several years ago examining the question, "No More Vietnams, Maybe." That was the title of the documentary. And they reviewed the enormous forces coming to play against each other in the Middle East, and concluded that, quite to the contrary, another awful conflict would likely occur in the Middle East, which would make our involvement as a nation in Vietnam seem like a minor experience by contrast. Well, what can be done about this? I'll say just a few words about what I'm trying to do. The reason that Israel's lobby is able to control the United States is because of its skill in using our political institutions. And by political institutions, I mean institutions that include government but are not limited to government. For example, they have enormous influence in news media, in the book publishing business, in the handling of television networks, in the handling of periodicals. It isn't that they own these institutions. Their influence comes about because of their skill in using avenues to public relations. For example, they are very skillful in keeping out of the news anything that's critical of the State of Israel. Now, they didn't quite succeed in blotting out the news of the uprising, but there has not been nearly as much coverage of the uprising the last few months as there was originally. They are very skillful in making Israel look good, no matter what it does. They're very skillful in downplaying the bad news about Israel. They play heavily upon ignorance. They have kept the American people from knowing how U.S. policy in the Middle East is made. That's really what my book is all about. How the lobby is able to control the making of U.S. policy in the Middle East. But they're so skillful in keeping down adverse commentary about Israel that hardly anyone in the country really knows what's going on. And those who do know, for the most part, are intimidated. They're afraid to speak out. They don't want to be accused of being anti-Israel. Because these days, being critical of Israel is the same as being anti-Semitic. And no one in America wants to be considered anti-Semitic. So I'm trying to spread information about how U.S. policy is made among the people of the United States. And despite the problems posed by Israel's lobby, the word is getting out. My book has sold about 75,000 copies. Another 30,000 will soon be distributed to opinion makers around the country. I've had letters from at least 800 individuals who've read my book and called me by telephone or written letters to me asking what they can do to help. So I'm providing them with something they can do. Let me tell you just a word about it, and then I'll sit down and we can have a further discussion if you would like. Thank you. My wife just put her watch up to her ear, so be assured that things are coming to an end. Washington is a city of lobbies. At least 40,000 individuals living in Washington, D.C. are engaged full-time in trying to influence the legislative process. Imagine that, 40,000. There are lobbies for and against gun control, for and against gay rights, for and against farmers, for and against clean air. The list goes on and on. Every subject seems to have a lobby working on both sides of the issue. And they serve a very important part of our governmental process. I'm not against lobbies. But in respect to the Middle East, the lobby for Israel has the field almost to itself. Now, there are some organizations of Arab Americans and some organizations consisting of people of the Muslim faith who live in the United States who are beginning to be active in the political scene. But they've only made a beginning. They are unable to match, to any degree at all, the efficiency of the lobby for Israel. Well, I see the need for a new lobby, not one that will seek to advance the interests of Egypt, or the interests of Syria, or the interests of Saudi Arabia, or any other Arab interest, but simply to advance the interests of the United States of America. Nothing else, just America. In other words, a pro-America lobby to work just on one thing, and that's political action at the grassroots in the United States in behalf of policies in the Middle East that make sense for our country. Almost no lobbying of this sort occurs, and I'm trying to get a lobby like that underway. And I'm seeking to get the people who've read my book to join in as political activists, to try to call up their congressman, call up their senator, when he comes back home to see him, and urge him to be fair to the interests of the United States in dealing with Middle East policy. What can you do? I dare say you have plenty of problems to deal with right here at home. But you do have opportunities to communicate with the people of the United States. And one of the things that you can help most on is to try to erase some of these false stereotypes that blind the American people to the truth about the world of Islam. You see, Israel's lobby does its very best to create a negative, false image of the Arab world, of Islam, of the PLO, of the Palestinians. Those are the terms that are the main targets of the lobby for Israel, and they do a pretty good job of making sure that these terms create a negative reaction on the part of the people of the United States. As you communicate with your friends in the United States, try to explain what Islam is all about. Try to show the common threads that bring Islam and Christianity together. Try to create understanding. One of the great barriers is ignorance. You can help dispel that. One of the great barriers is fear that arises from ignorance. You can help dispel that as well. I'm not a student of the great prophet, but I have learned that he said these words, or words very close to these words. He said that he who knows the truth and fails to speak out is like a mute devil. Have I quoted the prophet correctly? He who knows the truth and fails to speak out is like a mute devil. Well, none of you want to be a devil, nor do I. So speak out to your friends in America and help to bring understanding to them. In doing that, you will help to bring about the education of the American people, which I think is absolutely necessary if in the Middle East we were to avoid this dreadful conflagration, which could easily become worldwide and destroy everything that all of us cherish so much. Thank you.
Would like to ask or raise questions in relation to the topic of this evening. You are welcome to address any question you like to your distinguished guest. Sorry. With the mic. Yes, well, to facilitate communication, there's a mic here. You can come up here and address your question to the speaker and he will answer you.
Did I have any problem in getting my book published in the United States? Indeed, I did. In fact, I searched for a publisher for a year and a half while I was writing the text. Normally, an author will receive a contract with a book publisher before he even begins to write. My experience was exactly the other way around. I wrote the book before I finally got a publisher. I was turned down by at least 20 of the major book publishers on Madison Avenue. Several of them were very candid. They told me that they thought my book was well done. They felt it was an important topic, that a book should be published on it. But they said, we can't do it. We'll pay too high a price if we publish it. One of them dealt very heavily with paperback books, and he said, if we should publish this book, it will be at least 2 years before we can repair the damage that we will do to our normal outlets for paperback books. Another said that we will have too much trouble within our organization as a publishing house. Individuals who are so strongly for Israel will be so upset, it'll cause us no end of trouble. And beyond that, we will have difficulty with our distributors and suppliers. Well, fortunately, a small but respected publishing house named Lawrence Hill came forward, agreed to publish it, had great difficulty getting the major houses, the to carry it. The chain bookstores refused for quite a period of time. But fortunately, there were many citizens of the United States, most of them had Arab ancestry, who were very eager to have my book available to their neighbors. They kept calling bookstores and book chains often enough to get their attention, and finally my book was marketed to a considerable extent through normal channels. So I'm grateful to them. I guess my book has been the exception, because books critical of Israel almost never see the light of day.
Anyone else? Arab states have distanced themselves from this cause. How could we possibly see the emergence of an Islamic nation when we are ourselves suppressed, when the people who are governing Muslim countries are not too active, mainly the government as such? I mean, from your experience, what do you find of the Arab states as such, the governing yet? Have they paid interest to this or lip service mainly to the Jews and, of course, the Americans?
The Palestinians I talked to, for the most part, have not been critical. The Arab states have contended that if they provide a new homeland for the Palestinians, the pressure will be off Israel to restore Palestine to its rightful territory. And they have persisted in this. They have provided aid to the Palestinian movement, I think, on a regular basis. They continue to provide aid today through various channels to help the suffering of the people within the occupied territory. I'm not here to make a defense of their behavior, but they have their own reasons which seem to be sufficient to many of the Palestinian people. The Palestinians don't want to be Syrians. They don't want to be Lebanese. They don't want to be Egyptians. They want to be Palestinians. And I sense that this passion for nationhood is now very deep, deeper today than ever before. The children's movement, the movement of stone-throwing young people, I think has created a new unity and nationalistic spirit among the Palestinians, which is not going to go away, which will not die. In fact, I sense that no matter what the outside world does or does not do, no matter what the Arab states do in the way of rescue and help, that the Palestinians are going to continue their protest uprising until finally Israel feels the price is too high to pay and withdraws from the occupied territory. I talked with a Palestinian woman from Gaza when I was in Egypt several months ago. She had been able to get out to go to a conference. Her work is as a Quaker among Palestinian youth. Her mission is to help young Palestinians in the Gaza district who suffer with stress, which must be an enormous personal problem among such young people. And she said that she visited a hospital one day, saw a young man in the hospital, had a bandage on his stomach. He had been injured by the Israeli forces during an uprising in which he took part. And she went over to him and, in a sympathetic way, asked, would you like to have me see your wound? And his response was, and he had a gleam in his eye, he said, which one? He had a wound on the back of his shoulder as well as the one on his stomach. She sensed a fierce determination on the part of that young man to stay with the cause. He was proud of the injuries he had sustained. He wasn't about to quit. And she said that is typical of the reaction she gets among the Palestinians. And the women are in the forefront of the movement. She told of another experience. She said that a young boy, I think about 9 years old, was being beaten up by the Israelis, by Israeli forces in Gaza. And a flood of women came on the scene. There were about four or five soldiers, and dozens of women simply smothered the soldiers who were beating up on this young man and enabled the young man to run away. She said, equal rights for women has arrived. There's a new family spirit in the new Palestine, which she said is going to stay, because the young people and the women have been at the side of the men in this great struggle. And she found it exhilarating.
What's the reaction of the State Department for you coming to South Africa on this cause, actually?
I didn't tell them. Quite often, as a former member of Congress, I do let the State Department know when I visit a foreign country. I saw no point to it. My mission here this week is to speak under the auspices of the Islamic Propagation Center International to talk about Middle Eastern policy. And I knew from experience that the State Department officials here would not feel free to engage in a discussion of this topic with me. At least a discussion would be useful, so I didn't bother. I hope they will forgive me.
I just wanted to know that in Iran they seem to have this kind of hate parade against America, you know, death to America kind of thing. And is it possible that they might know about this network that we have discussed this evening? Is it possible that they probably know about the network, which we don't know about? That might be the reason that they have got this kind of attitude.
Well, I didn't state it very clearly earlier in my comments. But very definitely, one of the tactics of Israel's lobby is to create this curtain between the Muslim world and the United States. For example, one of my chapters deals with what happened at the University of Arizona in Tucson, where the university had a program which was intended to spread knowledge among the high schools of the state about the Arab world and, of course, about Islam. Well, the local Jewish community council saw this as against the interests of the State of Israel to have this educational program carried out. And over a three-year period, through very disgraceful but effective tactics, they literally ground that educational program to dust. And it doesn't exist today. So Israel's lobby presents an enormous problem in removing this barrier between the Muslim world and the American people. And we both have to work at the task of tearing it down. But once it's removed, and both the Muslims and the Christians see how many common interests we have together, I'm sure that great things can follow. Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed very much being with you tonight, and God bless all of you.